Hi everybody, I'm Deb Dwyer. I'm from the School of Health Technology and Management. Welcome today to this session on gender and class. I think we have four really experienced experts on this topic. I think it's going to be a great session. So I'm not going to take a lot of time to talk, so I want to introduce the format. We'll be able to introduce all four speakers, give you a little bit of background of who they are and what they're talking about, and then we'll proceed right into their talk. They each get 15 minutes to talk. We will hold on questions until the very end. Speakers will present, and then they will come up as a panel, and we should have between 20 to 25 minutes for questions and answers in the end. Okay? So our first speaker is Dr. Francine Macho, who is the director of the Institute for Women at Work at the ILR School at Cornell University, and she will be talking to us. Did I get that wrong? Her affiliation is the Institute for Women at Work, and she'll be talking about live wires for a labor cause, women electricians in New York City. Our second speaker, Dr. Hester Eisenstein from Sociology Department at Queens College, and she will be talking about feminism seduced, how global elites use women's labor and ideas to exploit the world. Our third speaker is Hanabantu Iverson, who is a political scientist in the History Labor Studies Department at Indiana University Northwest, talking about beyond reductionism, seeing class through race and gender in black healthcare workers' lives. And finally, Melda Usher, did I get that right? Economics Department, Anadolu Mayıs University. Public Finance, Istanbul University. Women's labor and tobacco, our topic will be women's labor and tobacco producing before and after privatization. So I look forward to all four. Without further ado, Dr. Macho. And 15 minutes per speaker, and I will hold up time when there's 2 minutes left. When you see a sign, 2 minutes.
Thank you very much. It's a 10-year research, but I'm sure 15 minutes will suffice. Just to show you how much you can collapse if you need to. Really what I did is, you know, when I got the conference theme, I said, oh, this is, you know, very apropos for research in my style. And I said that it doesn't present it in that way. The first theme that's laid out by the conference is really to explore the explicit recognition of class and ways in which the analysis of society can deepen our understanding of class. Now, in this book and in this study, what happens, what looks like a group of workers and that's homogeneous as a class, I did a study of the construction industry, the electrical construction trade in New York City. The union was a specific union because it was one of the largest in the country. It's Local 3 of the IBEW, and it's also the most powerful. And I would probably argue after doing this research, it's even much more powerful than the international itself, or at least at one time. So I look deeply into the class of workers. Oh, these are all men, these are all construction workers. However, there's a very, very, let's say, clear understanding when you look closely, with a very close lens, at a union or a trade or an occupation. In this electrical construction union, it's an enormous amount of class of workers. And that class of workers, whether they be journeymen, apprentices, which is a rundown, a journeyman is a master mechanic, and that person can even run a shop or own a business. An apprentice is, as they say, lower than a whale ship, pardon my phrase. And then, however, they are very privileged because they're within the traditional union program. Then there are trainees that come in through public policy and municipal regulations, and they're most and majority women, oftentimes, and minorities. And then there are those people who are what they call salted. And those are workers who get unionized when the union goes on the work site to have them sign cards, and those people are usually immigrants. So it's not, you know, the simple class and gender kind of situation. When we go in more clearly, more explicitly, there are different classes of workers, and that has different repercussions. Most of, I would say, 98% of the journeymen are white European American. Most of the apprentices that are in the traditional program is about 2% women, and most of the ghost workers are white, also from a European American background. The trainees are by and large black, Hispanic, Jamaican, and Caribbean, and other areas, and oftentimes women, and there have been a lot of Asian women coming in as well. Apparently Asian women are involved very much in China in sports, and going into a rough, tough industry is something that's not that really foreign to them. So class and gender are really connected in that way. And those relationships are formalized, and they're conscious. They don't just happen. And they're reproduced as well. The other theme that was laid out was the point of reference of the lived experience of these workers. Well, that's why, seriously, I did this 10-year study. I was a professor in an electrical industry apprenticeship program that ended in a degree in labor studies, and I talked to a handful of women who were in the program, and then I talked to the employers and the contractors, and the contractors were going absolutely berserk about this, like, 3 or 4 women that were in the program. And, you know, I said, well, this doesn't make sense. You know, we have these guys that's on billions of dollars of skyscraper work. And then I looked more deeply, and I found out that both the union and the joint board and the contractors are collusive organizations. You don't have one without the other. The union is able to keep the industry unionized through the relationship of the electrical contractors, the business side. So the union graduates journeymen, and then those journeymen become electrical contractors, and then they hire union electrical workers. See, so that's how it works. And it's very purposeful. That's how you do it. Now, that's great. So, you know, and that's how the Germans and the Irish did it, and the Scots, and everyone else. However, you know, when you got to the 1960s and the blacks tried to get in, they were shut out of the electrical industry because of, one, the unions, and especially the craft union like Global Free, doesn't let anybody. It's an equal opportunity exclusionary. And the second thing is that it was a time where race relations were up and coming, and there were changes happening. The only way the blacks got in was through direct action. I'll make this story very short. They went to sites like Holland Hospital, they demonstrated, they picketed, they got the jobs in the community. However, why aren't there more black electricians in Manhattan, in this union? Why? Because the blacks were not able to make the inroads to the market niche, like the Germans and the Scots and the Irish, and there were men. And why, during the feminist movement in the 1970s, did 2% of women get in to Local Free and the apprenticeship program and never expanded those numbers? Part of it is that the contractors didn't want them there. And also, part of it was that they were also never able to make a niche in the industry. And that's the relationship, oftentimes, between class and gender, ethnicity, and race. Hispanics coming in at the, let's say, 1980s, 1990s, they're in larger proportion than either women or blacks into the industry. You say, oh, there we go. That's pretty puzzling why they're a newer immigrant group. They should be at the bottom rung of the class structure, and these are Hispanic men, but instead they're making really good progress and inroads. They were able to develop those informal networks and niches with very strong family connections. connections and ties in the industry, and somehow the Hispanics were able to keep their own women out, but bring in their own relatives. Now, what did this local do, and how did it deal with both this ethnic succession of New York City, because people are still coming. Now, really, there's globalization in New York City in construction. So you have people from Ecuador, Central America, from Russia, from all over. Well, the union devised two separate divisions. Let's make it a little simple, but it's more complex than this. One division was female, the other division was male. The male division was the smaller division. It was only about, if you like, a rough figure, 8,000 electrical craft workers in construction, who were all men. And then the rest, about 35,000 or so, were women in electrical-related industries, in supply houses, in manufacturing, when they used to produce the bait lights for all the switches that you see here. And the way that Harry Van Onsdale, who was the head of this union and was a central figure in developing its structure along the lines of class, race, gender, and ethnicity, believed that if everybody had their niche and you gave them, you know, some opportunity, then you would keep the construction division more powerful in the union. And the way he rationalized organizing women in the 1930s in the electrical manufacturing divisions was by saying, we're not organizing them because they're women. We don't care. We don't even know that. We're organizing them because they, you know, we're brothers and we make a lot of money and we have to protect lower income workers. And here you have really the use and the fermentation of a concept of brotherhood that takes this union on this amazing journey of being able to rationalize things that happened. For instance, during the Civil Rights Movement in the 60s, there were all this conflict going on. The iron workers just settled their case. Must have been about, you know, a year ago. The Steamfitters just settled their case for racial discrimination from the 1960s, about 3 years ago. Yeah. Local 3, what they did is they developed a club. They called it Lewis Latimer, Howard Lewis Latimer Club. It was that he was a black electrician who helped Thomas Edison in Montclair, New Jersey, develop the arts and entertainment part of the electrical industry. Every ethnic group had a club. Now, Van Onsdale, when the women came in, he had already set up for those manufacturing women a women's committee. And then the big guys, the construction workers, had their, you know, their social clubs. They had, you know, the St. George Club, the Greeks, and they had the Catholic Club, the Irish. And these were powerful clubs. These were networks of internal societies that intermingled with the municipality and got people appointed and elected to office so that the electricians could control the building codes. Because if they controlled the politics and the building codes, they could then control the labor demand and supply. So here come these women. They sit online in the 1970s. There's about 6 of them. And the press is there, and they want a recruitment application. So, and they want to be electrical apprentices in the construction division. Well, you know, in terms of the brotherhood concept, this didn't fit at all. Because, you know, if women are in the part of the brotherhood that's supposed to be paternalistic toward women, toward those women manufacturing, okay, I mean, we know they got to work, they're poor, so we can understand that, and we're going to subsidize them. But, you know, because they know where to go. They know their place. Here were women that were coming in, and they throwing the whole configuration away. It was as if their mother or sister or daughter came in on the worksite, and they were never used to seeing that. So, you know, by and large, and in conclusion, I just want to say, because my time is up, is that what women presented, other different than other ethnic and racial groups in this union, what they faced, even though there were six of them at that time, was the fact that their entire rationale and structure of brotherhood, of who belongs where, and the concept of identity, where is your place, and you're going to keep it. And that's how we've arranged things institutionally. It's worked for years. Now everything was exploded. Who's a man, who's a woman? I just have to tell you a story, and then I'll stop. This is a wonderful story. When I first started doing this research, I asked the president of the union, could he tell me when the first woman electrician came in? And he said to me, 1974. So I said, but Dennis, you know, the legislature was 78, and the first six women who came in, you know, got online and became journeymen, because of 1978. So 74 sounds very early to me. He said, no. He said, we had a guy, and he had an operation, and he became a woman, and his name is Jackie, and we have sent her around to all of the programs and the recruitment sessions as our first woman electrician. So I said to him, but then I said, wasn't it a little difficult for people to digest that in the membership? He said, oh no. Okay, why not? He said, well, at least we know she was a man at one time.
Dr. Eisenstein next will talk about feminism seduced. Sorry, how well the elites use women's labor and ideas to exploit the world.
Do you have a? I don't have a slide. Thank you so much. I'm still laughing about the So the title of my session. Is in fact the title of this book, which is just going to unpack it. And so what I'm going to do is read you or speak to a section of the book that talks about the issue of class within the women's movement. And just by way of introducing the book, this is a book from the left. I mean, I feel like I should have a little sign. It's not designed to trash feminism. I'm writing as a long-term women's studies activist and feminist activist and academic. But it's also written more in sorrow than in anger. It's really an attempt to see where mainstream feminism has come. And what mainstream, I'm calling it mainstream or hegemonic feminism. And I don't really have space in the book to talk about all the other kinds of feminisms that there are. The final chapter is a series of recommendations for coming back to a much more radical, dare I say, socialist feminism as really the only path forward. So I'm only going to give you a little taste of it. I have a couple of copies with me if people want them. Okay, one is the room, two, that's it, go ahead. They're also in the bookstore. Oh, wait, three? Ooh, three. And they're also in the bookstore where, I don't know where it is, on the campus. So, there they are. Come in after.
I can tell you where the bookstore is at.
Oh, good. Thank you. Okay. All right. So, the part I'm going to just read you a little bit from the book looks at, I'll just give you the framework of the book. I have a chapter, How I Came to Write the Book, which is autobiographical. Then I have a chapter on globalization and women's labor, which is really an overview of globalization and the uses being made of women's labor. a chapter on fault lines of race and class, a chapter on the United States, the political and economic sea change that brought in neoliberalism, then a chapter in the Global South, where I argue that women are being used to replace development. Do you even know, this is such a great audience, come to this conference, I don't have to do a lot of explanation. And then the last chapter, the substantive chapter, is Islamophobia and the Global War on Terror, where I talk about the uses of women. And I mean, just there was just an example, about 2 days ago in the New York Times, did you see that article about the women Marines and what a difference they're making? They go to Afghanistan, and with the bombs falling and the IEDs and so on, they are used to speak to the women and teach them about the greatness that America's bringing them. You know? So, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. Okay, and then the last chapter is a series of recommendations for moving toward a more radical, confrontational feminism. So let me just, I'm going to just give you a little taste of it, and this is the chapter on the what's called Women, Work, and the Mainstreaming of Feminism. So it's a kind of a history. And the issue that I take up is the issue of protective legislation versus the idea that happened in the 60s, and it really dovetails with this previous paper, because all those issues were within the union movement, going back to the 30s and the 40s. So I just, I'll read you a little bit and then I'll talk. I know it's 15 minutes, so it's not all. From the 1880s onward, with the transformation of U.S. capitalism from the small businesses of the pre-Civil War era to the first giant monopoly corporations in oil and steel, the structure of business began to require massive infusions of clerical labor. With the introduction of the typewriter to industry by the Remington and Sons Company, the reconfiguration of clerical work as a woman's arena took place over a remarkably short period of time as manufacturers drew on a substantial pool of educated white women who were largely excluded at that time from other professions. In 1880, only 4% of the clerical labor force were women. By 1890, the figure had jumped to 21%. And by 1920, women made up 50% of the clerical workers as well. I'm sorry, clerical workers, as well as 50% of all low-level office workers. And you know the story, those of you who teach women's studies, from male clerks wearing green eye shades and sitting on high stools to write down columns and figures, the typical clerical worker became a white, educated, unmarried woman, the Gibson girl, wearing the ready-to-wear shirtwaists being sewn in sweatshops downtown by her immigrant sisters. The telephone industry similarly hired young white women, and increasingly then, women are being drawn into this industrialized workforce. And the fight over access by women goes all the way back to then, continues to this very minute. And there was a complication in the debate with the emergence of early 20th century feminism, defined as the idea that women can and should have independent incomes. So at this very moment, debate that we're familiar with broke out. For example, in Seattle, among labor activists over the role of working women. For example, married women who embraced the new feminist ideal, and this is right after World War I. Working class feminists in Seattle clashed head on with opponents of married women's employment who subscribed to the ideals of the family wage and the moral economy. This is from work by Greenwald, some of you may know her writing. Wage work by married women violated both ideals. The family wage ideal, in which a male breadwinner earned enough to support his wife and children, constituted a class aspiration shared by men and women. The idea of the moral economy postulated that financial need alone should determine who had a legitimate claim to wage work. From both perspectives, married women had no right to work except in cases of absolute economic necessity. So the fight about access to trade work is all related to that. As does the fight over protective legislation. And you know, we look back now and go, oh yeah, protective legislation. We're very much, my generation, and I assume succeeding generations, are very imbued with the 1960s, 70s feminist ideal that we can compete on equal terms. And we don't need protection for our delicate reproductive functions, which was the ideology that governed protective legislation. But in fact, if you look back at the debate, it's really interesting, because in the 1920s, all the way from the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, when the labor movement was powerful, it was actually very powerful. Young people here, we had a powerful labor movement. Some white feminists developed an ideology of women's rights that challenged the protectionist consensus that lay behind the family wage concept. And so there was a debate over protective legislation which raged among different groups of feminists from the 20s till the 60s. And it encapsulated two opposing concepts of the role of working women. On the one hand, the new feminists argued that women should be as free as men to compete for work in an open market. On the other hand, other feminists, usually union activists, bitterly opposed this idea, arguing that women in the workforce required a range of protections given their unique role as wives and mothers. From the perspective of the early 21st century, this famous debate over protective legislation has echoes in the contemporary debate between neoliberal advocates of the so-called free deregulated market and their opponents who seek an active role for government in the operations of the economy. And I don't know if you saw Obama the other day trying to, you know, jumpstart his presidency around the actions that he's taking in the Gulf. And he was speaking, you know, in the language of government intervention, championing government intervention, trashing the free market, which is a pretty good sell given what's happened to our coastline. So the Equal Rights Amendment, and I didn't know that until I had to do this research, was championed not just famously by the National Women's Party and by Alice Paul, but was also backed by business. It was business that said, let's have equal rights, meaning let's have women compete in a free market without protection. And of course, if you look at it for 2 seconds, you can see that this is a class divide. Because who can compete? The women who were beginning to get law degrees, the first doctors, the first professionals, the women who were entering that middle class arena. Who was it that needed protection? It was low wage women workers who often didn't have, for example, protection from maternity leave, although they fought for it within the unions. So it would be nice to have legislation. So you see that it's actually the notion of competing varies by class. And that, of course, is still true as we speak. Now, there's a long story. It's very complicated, and probably a lot of you know it. There was a little fight about it. Eventually, the Equal Rights Amendment not only became a mainstream demand as the protective legislation fell away in the 1960s, and as women really moved into what I call a mainstream ideology of competing in the open market with men, not wanting protection, not wanting special access. And then the Equal Rights Amendment came under attack by the right, whereupon every feminist in the world has defended because it was taken up as a symbol by the radical right. Well, everything was wrong with feminism. So a very complicated story. But the reason I tell it in the book is to point to the issue of class and take us back to the issue of class within the women's movement. And to look also at sometimes how women's interests vary by class. And those of you who know the 20th century story, there was an effective cross-class alliance around the early unionizing, famously with the before and after the Triangle Fire in New York, the strike by women workers, and it was middle class and upper class women who helped to fund and and helped to publicize. And that was an effective moment across class lines. So I really raised the question in the end of the book of how can we come back to this issue of class as a central element in defining feminist struggles and feminist roles. And what's the role of a cross-class alliance? So I'll just read you a tiny bit from here, I'm conscious of the time. But a cross-class alliance, as I was saying, is part of the secret of the political power of the women's movement in the progressive era. Such a cross-class alliance is equally necessary now. In the current era, middle-class women's issues are closer to working-class issues, namely longer hours, the conflict between work and parenting, and the lack of social support for caregiving work. But as Dorothy Sue Cobble argues, the women's movement has a class problem. This is, and I'm quoting her here, a failure to incorporate class as a continuing and central category of analysis, not to speak of an element in the strategy and development. But the interesting thing is that class is coming back to bite us, both here and around the world, in an ironic twist, because and my whole book is on the premise that the economy has shifted toward a service economy. That's what brought women into the labor force in massive numbers, and that's what has now brought a revival of union work led by, in some cases, by women. So a very interesting set of developments. And I talk a lot about the nurses' union in California and their brilliant, brilliant tactics. And I just have to read you this particular report. I tell just a little story about the California Nurses Association, where Roseanne Morrow is in fact a former women's studies major, did you know that? Who became the head of the nurses union and very powerful organizer and brilliant, using feminist consciousness. And that's one thing I'm trying to say is that where does class fall now in terms of feminist strategy? Look at the rise of service unions, look at the rise of organizing outside unions. We just got the domestic workers bill passed, I think, in the Senate yesterday. So there's a flurry of action around women and working class women. So this is what they did. The California Nurses Association, they were attacking Schwarzenegger because he was attacking their work conditions. Both he was not respecting reasonable staff ratios of nurses to patients, but also his anti-labor electoral propositions. So this is an account of what the nurses did. Over the next year, protesting squads of women in surgical scrubs, gravings, and he said the nurses were a special interest. That was his attack. So, protesting squads of women in surgical scrubs, waving signs that said patients are our special interest, dodged Schwarzenegger at every public appearance. They buzzed his Super Bowl party in a rented plane. They dubbed Air Arnold. Waving a banner that meant it's no party for nurses. They showed his fundraisers, including a Rolling Stones concert in Boston, where a plane dragged an Arnold's Beast of Burden corporate cash banner over Fenway Park, and a Tony event in New York where California nurses snuck in as guests and chastised him in front of paying customers. And the best thing, they put Arnold up for auction on eBay. And they raised $3.6 million before the site took the auction. So I'll stop, but I'm trying to connect that history of class struggle in the women's movement in the 20s, 30s, 40s, within the union movement and outside, to what we're looking at now. It's one of my directions for the future. So thanks a lot.
You could have that to follow up in World Landing at the end of the book. So we have Dr. Tanabasu Iverson again talking about reduction beyond reductionism, seeing class of race and gender, and healthcare workers' lives, black healthcare workers.
You all please excuse me for working at this while I'm talking. Okay. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for coming. I'm sure you've been someplace else. But certainly thank you for taking time to come and allow us to share with you, and hopefully you'll have some things to share with us. The presentation is entitled Beyond Reductionism, Seeing Class Through Race and Gender in Black Healthcare Women's Lives. This is a an opportunity for me to share with you research that I did on my dissertation, which I happened to complete 3 years ago, actually 4 years ago, graduated right after that. So this is still something that I agonized over this, as you can imagine, and it still is beginning to take on great meaning for me. These are findings and implications of a qualitative study which I did with African-American healthcare workers in Gary, Indiana. Let me just say, what I intend to do is, I have it laid out here, I'm just going to talk just a few seconds on methodological notes, then you'll have a brief description of study subjects. I'm going to talk about some of the key findings that I gleaned with respect to the conditions and strategies of women healthcare workers. And then I'd like to end briefly talking about a few of the implications that I think we can draw from all of this. Let me just say a couple of things methodologically. Having been exposed to black feminist work in both my social movement experiences and graduate school during the 1980s and 1990s, I started a project in which I could both apply and test a number of key theoretical and political ideas brought to the fore by feminists in general, feminists of color in particular. So making contact with a number of African-American women workers as a result of contacts that I had within SEIU, which is the union in which I was a health and safety organizer for about 2 years before my job was restructured out from under me. I eventually began to be able to engage with about 15 women healthcare workers and was over time able to convince them to participate with me in this study. The focus of the study was to investigate the workplace conditions and strategies of survival and resistance of African-American women healthcare workers, and to look at those conditions and strategies as the women experienced them themselves. And so to that extent, it was a phenomenological qualitative study in which I tried with the women to prepare the questions and then tried to allow them to talk with me about how they experienced both their workplaces and to inform me about some of the things that they did in order to survive and resist. The time frame for the study was 1980 to 2000, and I chose this because I wanted to be able to learn more about the ways in which the subjects had been impacted by, one, the ebbing of black power struggles in Gary, Indiana. Those of you who know anything about Gary know that it has a rich history not only as a steel worker center, but as a center of black political striving, particularly having been one of the Gary, Indiana being one of the two cities, Cleveland and Gary, where African Americans actually became mayors in the 60s, in the 60s and 70s. I wanted to find out the impact of the ebbing of black power struggles in Gary. I also wanted to look at the way in which Garyites have been affected by the onset of restructuring in the Northwest Indiana area. And I also wanted to take a look at the way people have been shaped by the intensification of white racial backlash in Gary, Indiana, in relationship to the political successes that African Americans had begun to achieve under Richard Hatchett. Let me just say one other thing, and that is that as a political scientist, I had a hunch that because black women had been so historically and contemporarily marginalized, particularly in neoliberal times,
an investigation of the conditions of their agency, their conditions and their agency, would help to make the oppressions and their strivings more visible, to make their oppressions and strivings more visible. In turn, by becoming more intellectually and emotionally engaged with their oppressions, I would argue our oppressions as well, scholars and activists could increase opportunities not only to interrogate, to interrupt, but also to intervene. So let us describe, briefly, these women. 15 African-American working-class women who worked in dairies, hospitals, and nursing homes during the years 1980 to 2000. At the time of the study, subjects ranged from 42 to 71 years of age. Most of the subjects were born and reared in Gary and were members of families that had migrated to what some people have called the Great Migration, from areas of the South, in order to find gainful employment and to escape domination and violence. Several of the women are currently married. Most have been married and are either divorced or have lost husbands in death. All were high school graduates and have attained a GED. All have been members of SEIU. Some are still members of SEIU. And all are currently caring for older and younger family members. Let me just say that when I speak of the oldest and the youngest, at the time of the study, the oldest woman that I was working with had been born in 1933. The youngest had been born in 1962. All right. Subjects revealed several broad occupational categories, which you can see here on the screen, and as you're looking at those, let me just say a couple of things very quickly. As I began to get to know these women and to talk with them, one of the most notable problems that they began to reveal was, frankly, the invisibility of their labor, not only their physical labor, but their mental and emotional labor. In fact, it is this invisibility, largely due to both the denigrating representations of black women and the gender and race typing of African-American women's service work, that so often contributes to the devaluation of both the women who do such work and their labors as well. And certainly Evelyn McConnell Glenn has helped us to understand this much better. One of the things I'd like to do is just very quickly share with you something she says that resonated with me as I listened to these women tell me their life and work stories. McConnell Glenn says the following about the reproductive labor in which these women were involved. Some of them are still involved in it. What exactly is the nature of the reproductive labor that these largely minorities and supposedly unskilled aides and assistants perform? They do most of the day-to-day, face-to-face work, caring for the ill and disabled, helping patients dress or change gowns, taking vital signs, assisting patients to shower or giving bed baths, emptying bed pans and assisting patients to the toilet, changing sheets and keeping the area tidy, and feeding patients who cannot feed themselves. There is much dirty work, such as cleaning up incontinent patients. Yet there is also another unacknowledged mental and emotional dimension to the work. Listening to the reminiscences of elderly patients to help them hold on to their memory, comforting frightened patients about to undergo surgery, and providing the only human contact some patients get. This caring work is largely invisible, and the skills required to do it are not recognized as real skills. Now, this is a little bit close to me because my mother-in-law, who is like my mother, just passed a couple of years, days ago. So it's a little close to me because I'm talking about the women who did that work with my mother. You understand? So when you stop to think about the invisibility of that kind of labor, and yet the centrality of that kind of labor to a family's life and the life of an individual, you begin to get a sense of how these women actually just they moved me very deeply. and their stories are stories that I think we have to understand from the inside out if we are to understand accurately how they experience class. Because as you will see, we can't make sense of their class experience unless we understand how that experience has been racialized and gendered at the same time. Am I making sense?
Yes.
Okay, all right. So you see these conditions. I won't read them for you. You've already been able to read them. But you see the range. All right. Now, what I'd like to do real quickly is just bring forward a couple of types of discrimination. And some of this is humorous. I don't mean any offense to anyone. I think perhaps, let me just say this, my white comrades and compañeras, don't get upset because this particular woman is, some of these folks are very straight, no chaser. They don't, they're just straight Scots. So this first example, actually, I think if we begin to parse it, you'll begin to see that this is not just an example of the racial discrimination that author Jean was trying to describe. But she began to talk about race discrimination. She said we were, and she's talking here about an exchange she had, what we might call a captive audience meeting between the owner of Wildwood Nursing Home, which is now defunct in the area, it no longer exists. But at the time, in the 80s, this man, Crump, was a black millionaire, okay? And he owned this nursing home in which all the women who worked, most of the women who worked, were black. So he had this meeting where he found out that people were about to go on strike. And the reason they were about to go on strike was because they didn't have medical insurance. Now, you understand it. Imagine that all of us are part of a labor force and we are helping people who are sick. They have insurance. The boss has insurance. The administrators have insurance. We cannot afford to get sick and lie in the beds that we change. We can't afford to use the bedpans that we empty. Okay, so she's talking here about how he talked to her and he said, you know, you're only black women, you're single parents, you can't fight me. And she says, she talks about this, and at a certain point I said, well, this was racial discrimination, right? She said, yeah. I said, well, what about gender discrimination? Oh, no, there's no gender discrimination. I didn't experience any gender discrimination. Well, what about, no. You know what? I need to back up. You know how you get wound up sometimes? Let me back the tape up. She talked about this as class experience. A class, she was talking about what I labeled socioeconomic discrimination. Okay. But when I asked her if she had experienced any race discrimination, she said, no, Tommy Bonson, because the boss, the owner, was black. There was no race discrimination. This was all about class. So I said, okay. So I waited about 10, 15 minutes, and later when we went back, I said, do you mind if I probe with you a little bit? She said, no, go ahead. I said, if this man, though he was black, and if his daughter, though she was black, if they were talking to you in ways that were demeaning, if they were saying to you, you're just black women, you are, you're not educated, you can't fight me, you're just women. If he was using those kind of terms with her, do you think that maybe that had something to do with the fact that you were black and woman? And she says to me, just like you see it here, she said, I see what you mean. Now, I hope you get a little bit of the flavor of this, because what was happening there for her and for me is that in parsing this socioeconomic issue and looking at what this man actually did to try to disrupt this possible strike, he was using the representations of racism and the representations of gender to manufacture a situation in which he could keep these workers down in a class manner. Okay, all right, so let's move on. I got 2 minutes, okay. I hate to do this, but I'm gonna have to. Okay, types of discrimination that were acknowledged by order. racial discrimination, socioeconomic discrimination, gender discrimination. They talked about what I later began to call convergence discrimination. I used that term during the coding and analysis stages to capture the notion that people were talking about different kinds of experiences of oppression. They did not necessarily use the term intersectionality. They didn't talk about feminism. They didn't talk about, you know, simultaneity and yada yada. But they understood very clearly that there was something different about the way they were experiencing different things. And I think that bodes, I think that says something to us. It says that people understand a lot more a lot of times than we give them credit for. They also talked about discrimination linked to workplace activism. Devaluation of work, invisibility, you see these conditions here. Time is moving. Okay, I think I can move on. When we look at the strategy that the women talked about, I had a hunch initially that we would find basically three kinds of strategies. Adopted in workplaces prior to the existence of a union, collective strategies adopted prior to the existence of a union, and personal and collective strategies in which workers engaged after a union was established. Now, what I found out, I'm going to come back. Remind me to come back to John, because I want to crack you up. There were actually four strategies that I found here, and this resonates, I think, with the work of some other feminists, for example, the strategies to defend and support oneself, strategies to defend and support one's co-workers. Also, I found amongst the women, and I think this is some of the work that Louise Lamphere has raised up, you find strategies to defend and support patients and their families. In other words, these women workers found ways to work even when they were striking. They did what they could to take care of the patients, because it was not just about their well-being, it was about the well-being of the women. So they were not just fighting for their own medical card. They were also fighting to make sure that the women were being changed as they should be. One woman, even when she went to management, said, listen, we need some different kind of gloves. Management didn't do anything. This worker went out and bought gloves with her own money. She bought perfume. She bought lotions for the women because she said, you know, these are our patients. We can't have them smelling them, talking about them. We have to take care of them. That says something about an ethic, not only of justice, but an ethic of care. Okay. So let me talk a little bit real quickly about the implications. Since social locations can contribute to the development of social consciousness, in 2010, we ought to be daring to consistently recognize the practical and theoretical significance of feminism of color. Now, I want to underscore theoretical, because I have a number of friends who consider themselves leftists and Marxists, and they talk about, well, you know, we got to be careful what we're saying here because there's a lot of women. But I'm not talking about an ethics of being careful. I'm talking about recognizing that there is theoretical significance to what women say and do and what they live. And see, well, why are you doing this, Tommy Bonsu? Are you trying to make friends? No. I'm beginning to recognize that when you talk about the theoretical significance, you're understanding that you have to see people's lives as they see them, and that makes some difference not only in how you analyze oppression, but how you seek to go about intervening in it. All right? So the second point is that analysis of experiences and agency have political and organizational consequences. We must become more conscientious in our teaching, research, organizing, and politics about paying attention to the constitutive, not the additive, but the constitutive nature of oppression. In other words, we're not thinking in terms of adding oppression one on top of the other. We're talking not only about the presence of multiple oppressions in the same spaces, but we're also talking about how those oppressions shape one another, which makes it a much messier and more complicated issue. And the last thing I'll say is we have to shift our center. As I move from this seat, we have to shift our center and interrogate the reductionist errors of our left. Thank you very much.
This is a very difficult part of my
Now,
thank you.
And here's yours. One group, city program.
Thank you. Dr. Albrecht, our comments, we'll talk about female labor and tobacco production.
Thank you. Hi, everybody. I want to present the results of the survey to be conducted in the provinces of Samsun or Bakura together with my colleague, Özgün Aksan, but she couldn't come. Here, she sent her solidarity to all of you. Okay, you can see the room now working in tobacco plant in Bakura. We carried out our survey in the villages of Bakura in August 2009. Bakura is the county of Samsun, one of the provinces of the Greater region, and it is one of the main centers in tobacco farming since the 19th century. We interviewed farmer families from Edirne village. Almost all families have their own land, and women work as unpaid family workers. Until 2000, every family had grown tobacco. However, in 2009, only 10 tobacco producer families were left. At the beginning of our study, we had two major aims. First one is to make female labor visible in tobacco farms, and second one is to reveal the impact of privatization of tobacco on women and their families in the rural areas. Second, means state tobacco monopoly was privatized in the process of the destruction of capital after the 2001 crisis of Turkey. Turkey, in fact, faced a serious crisis in 2001, and it has experienced various transformations in the capital accumulation process after that. One of them has been carried out in agriculture. The change in the share of agriculture in GDP shows this change. In 2001, it was 14%, but in 2005, it came 10% only. And you can see this change in the female employment. The share of agrarian employment in total female employment has decreased also. In 1995, it was more than 70%, but in 2009, it became less than 50%. In fact, privatization of tobacco affected workers in tobacco industry. However, between December 2009 and March 2010, they staged one of the most important worker mobilization in Turkey since the 1980s. Privatization of tobacco, together with the abolition of the state subsidies, affected tobacco producer farms as well. Moreover, since tobacco uses tobacco in cigarette production, and tobacco can't be used without industrial processing, tobacco was also functioning as a bridge between industry and agriculture. You see, tobacco was a monopolist in the tobacco market, committed to purchasing all tobacco produce. Hence, small tobacco farmers were dependent on state subsidies. Tobacco also was a monopoly in domestic markets, especially for cigarettes, until 1984. Let's look at privatization of tobacco. As a first step, tobacco's commitment for being a monopolist in tobacco market was unleashed in 1994. Then, subsidy prices on tobacco were abolished in 2002. The next one is tobacco law. Tobacco law, which liberalizes the tobacco sector, phases out support purchases of tobacco and allows for the sale of cigarettes, was approved by the parliament in January 2002. And then the tobacco law provides the legal basis for establishment of the tobacco products and alcoholic beverages market regulatory authorities. In 2004, the share of state purchases has diminished to 30%. About 98% of the production is based on contract farming, and there is no special subsidy paid to tobacco producers. And in 2008, the car was sold to the British American Tobacco on February 2008 with a tender price that is equal to the amount of products the enterprise price could make just in 4 years. Now I will go on with tobacco production. In Bafra, at the beginning of the millennium, 20,000 families used to produce tobacco. But in 2002, in 2000, I remember, 9,000 families ended production, and in 2008, there were only 1,500 producer families or less. After 2001, many families have migrated from Samsun and Bafra to industrial steel. According to a survey, 50,000 people migrated in 5 years. After privatization of Teker in 2009, it hasn't made any purchasing contract with farmers. It means the tobacco market was totally left to the tobacco merchants or commercial companies. You see a girl in tobacco plants. Now I want to deal with the female labor now in tobacco production. Tobacco production depends on intensive family labor because mechanization is very limited in this activity. Farming is very difficult. Lasts from March to October. Seed planting and picking, swinging and sun drying of the leaves require dense labor processes. In houses, everyone from 10 years old child to 75 years old grandma work together. However, women bear most of the burden in tobacco farming. It is an all-day long work. In fact, women get up early in the morning, 5 or 6 o'clock, and go to the farm to pick up the tobacco leaves before they fall. About 10 o'clock, they come back home and after having breakfast, start tobacco drinking. Late in the afternoon, they go to the farm again. After dinner, they sling the leaves. All the women in the family participate in all the stages of tobacco production. Men start from almost transporting and collecting. In fact, there are many ways of citizenization of female labor in tobacco production. Especially leaf picking and leaf drinking are said to be the women's work. A man who we interviewed said that the families with daughters are always good at tobacco farming because girls are more hardworking, faster, and they have green fingers. In any family, tobacco farming continues till daughters get married. Fetia says that as soon as daughters leave, tobacco ends. Women do housework as well. Women undertaking most of the work of tobacco growing does absolutely not mean that men do housework. Both housework and tobacco work are seen as women's work. When we asked for interview, Hatice refused us. She explained, she said that I have just come back from leaf picking. I have no time to talk. I want to do washing, prepare dinner, look after grandma, meet the cows. When the weather becomes cooler, I will go to the farm again. I have nobody to help to do those work. What is ironic is that when we ask, what do you do? Women answer as I want to work. As you see, like hard work, farming is not expected as work when performed by women. In addition, we see that women do not have own social securities. They are included in social security system as a dependent if their husband has his own social security. We found out that tobacco farming nearly came to an end. It was definitely finished in some villages. For example, in the villages of Sitinjular, Sitinjular means tobacco producers. It took its name from tobacco farming. There means only two families producing tobacco. Now, merchants purchase tobacco under the production contract. They determine the quantity and the prices. Farmers said that the prices was terribly low and they could not afford even their basic needs. And most of them stopped tobacco production and moved to the big cities. But still, there's no working cities. In fact, and especially under the crisis conditions, and women do not have qualifications that urban jobs require, and it means unemployment for most of the women. While farmers, let me say that I finished, hence prices are very low, people do not afford their basic needs, and they need some extra financial resources. As they need credits, new credit resources have emerged, bank credits. Farmers put up only their land or tractor, if they have any, as collateral to the bank. We revealed that finance capital is in cooperation with merchant capital in credit relations. The bank gives credit to the farmers according to the tobacco production agreement, which was signed between them and the merchants. Merchants are both purchasers of tobacco and dealers of the machinery which are used in tobacco production. Merchants pay for tobacco via the bank. What is strange in terms of gender relations is that those are men who make contract with merchants, who open a bank account, who take bank credits, although the immediate producer of tobacco are women. These credit relations make farmers more dependent to the merchants and to the finance capital. In fact, we can expect that there will be handover in the land property in the near future. People have to dispose of their land. They will have to leave their land and migrate to the big cities or will become paid agricultural workers in their land. Because it seems big capitalist farms will be established in their land. And in the past, tekel means employment, secure jobs, state subsidies to the agriculture. It was a bridge between industry and the agriculture. But now, tekel was privatized. What is left is unemployment, insecure jobs, no state subsidies for the produce. Thank you very much.
Thank you to all four speakers. I think there was a common theme to all of this of how women are segmented into classes, and those classes tend to be undervalued to the point where the kinds of work they're doing is not even expected that they should be paid for it, because we should just do it because we're women. Very interesting common themes throughout. I'm going to ask all four panelists to please come up front to take questions at this point.
So it's time to open
it
up for discussion. And we have 15 minutes for questions and answers. So in the back of the room.
I just have a question for Tom. The thing that you said about right at the end about how the way, trying to understand how race and class and gender operate together, that we need to let that influence us also as activists about how we approach those things. And what I just wanted you to reflect more on is a little bit about how do you think it should, how will that change? Like for me, for example, as a white South African activist in South Africa, it's a major issue of trying to get to grips with these kinds of things. So I'd just like to hear more of your thoughts about how do you change the way you approach you sense as an activist, and how I think you should change the way we think about these things.
Well, thank you for the question. It's not an easy question, and there is no easy answer. And I don't even suggest that I have all of them. But let me just very quickly say this. It seems to me that if we take the experiences of women seriously, and particularly if we take the experiences of women of color seriously, then we need to begin to figure out organizationally how we relate to people in our organization so that those experiences are not further marginalized by the way in which we engage with people in the organizations that we try to put together. And I think it also has something to say about the politics that we use. How do we build our movements in ways that say we're all a part of this movement? How do we frame our demands so that not only a few people have their kinds of experiences, their demands being put to the fore in the forefront, while the rest of us feel like this organization is not really representing us? How do we engage in leadership development so that everyone has an opportunity to be a leader? What does it say about who can lead, who can think, who can work, who can make changes when we look at the oppressions of every group as constitutive of one another, rather than thinking that only white males or only white women have anything of real import in this organization, and other folks are just supposed to hand out leaders to make the coffee or do whatever we traditionally in the past had them to do. I think it forces us, when we take feminists seriously, not simply look at them and nod because we don't want to get in trouble in another city, we're going to get in trouble again. But if we take women's lives seriously, then it says something about what patriarchy has done not only to them but to us as males. It says something about what kind of relationships we not only have with women, we as men have with women, but what kind of relationships do I have with my grandson? How do I deal with my son? How do I deal with the gay man who wants to work in this organization, but my concept of heteronormativity, you know, makes it hard for me to work with him because I don't like those folks? To take seriously people's lives means that we have to take those lives serious all the time, not just in terms of what we say to them, but in what we say about the movement that we're building and the way we build the movement so that they are, so that they are a part of it. Does that make any sense? No? No? Okay.
No,
what doesn't make sense?
No, it makes sense. I'm trying to formulate something. There's a second question, but maybe I can come back
okay.
This time.
Okay. And if we don't get it here, we'll come back, please.
The gentleman.
Thank
you. Yeah. Thank you, everyone, for your really thoughtful, insightful, and funny presentation.
You can get all of
them. But one of the things I was struck by, all of you are talking about a particular time, it's a deregulation. It's a time when the state was pushed back, when the state had involvement, but where the state sold out literally, not necessarily made women's life better or worse in the case of Turkey. But I'm just wondering, and through your work, Paramatu as well, who do people appeal to, right, in terms of support, right? So you've got alliances that are of themselves. But Gary Indiana once, I don't know if it still does, but I remember, you know, that he was the first black mayor, or one of the first black mayor. So there's a constituency there locally at the civic level. And similarly, nationally, there was this Obama moment, some people think, right? So who do women appeal to in a deregulated environment? And who might they appeal to at these levels of scale, right? Whether it's New York, whether it's Gary Indiana, whether it's nationally, or locally in Turkey or Mexico. So it's a broad question about trying to understand at what moments you appeal to whom, who your alliance is within the state at these different levels. So that people aren't invisible, right? People evoke certain kinds of deregulation precisely to get women in place. But so you can't appeal to the state at that point because they're out to benefit from them. But anyway, it's a comment and a kind of a broader question.
Can I say that?
I just wanted to say, in the study of women construction workers, they were a very small group, yet they were very much divided by color and ethnicity and class. And, you know, the more feminists were divided from the lower income women and the minority women and women of color. And women of color saw race with men as more compatible and gender, you know, than having that solidarity from women. And it seemed so complicated that, and it sounds like it in your study too, that I really think you can only say that the confluence of circumstances that occur, you know, really sort of make a person define where their identity is. So it's like what's happening. For instance, these feminist women came from feminist organizations. They were white feminist women, and that's where their experience was from. Some of women of color came from generations of electricians that were black from their fathers. So it depends really on the circumstances. But if I just want to say to your question very briefly, I think this whole issue that you're raising of identity politics and how does one then identify and define like vulnerability or privilege or underclass. I mean, I think that if I had the ability to have a conference, and I'm putting this in the suggestion box, you know, is to critique. Let's do a critique of that, you know, go now retrospective. That role of the state, how it ended in identity politics, how it functions now, and do we need different categories to determine, you know, what privilege or vulnerability is?
I think that the whole literature, you know, there's a lot of writing about neoliberalism that's very inaccurate in my view, because it says, you know, there was an era of Keynesian intervention, and that ended, and now we have neoliberalism and there's no state. Well, the missing link is that the state brought in neoliberalism, governs it, makes rules for it, and comes in and out at will. If you look at the American scene now, you know, if AIG goes under, suddenly we have the state. You know, and we have, you know, Obama, the last Keynesian, you know. So I think that we should be aware of that and be strategic. And I mentioned, for example, the domestic workers campaign in New York just got a Bill of Rights passed through the Senate. It's now passed the Senate and the Assembly. They have to reconcile the bill. And this is a redress of something that happened in 1935, you know, when the minimum wage came in and the Social Security and so forth, and domestic workers and farm workers were eliminated from the bill to accommodate the Southern Democrats who otherwise wouldn't have allowed it to pass. And so from that day to this, these black women were excluded. Now they're being included using the state. Very old-fashioned. The legislature getting a law. Now, of course, it has to be enforced, and there's a million wrinkles. But I think that, to coin a phrase, we need to bring the state back in. and not take it as given, because a lot of it is propaganda. A lot of it is, you know, under neoliberalism, the state has no role. We only have private contractors, you know, they do everything. Which, I mean, by the way, is true in large extent, particularly in all these wars that we're waging. But I think that as people who left, we have to really have a debate. I mean, this is another conference idea. you know, what does it mean now? What is the left in all its variety, the union movement, the left of the union movement, etc.? What's our relationship to the state? I come out of a feminist generation that was very hostile to the state. I don't know if you guys remember this, but it was really, you know, bad. And I think that, but at the same time, by the way, and this is also an area that needs research. At the very same time that a lot of black feminists were like, we don't need the state, we're going to have little collectives, and we're going to do everything on our own. By the way, can we have some funding?
Yeah.
you know, So that whole issue of relationships, and now I pointed my last chapter to Venezuela, and I could have done Bolivia also, you know, very briefly, but to say there's now, if we have a state under a movement like Chavez and the people who support Chavez in Venezuela, there's a very interesting struggle and complex thing going on between grassroots organizing and state power with oil money behind it.
Yeah.
Not that I'm endorsing that, right? It's environmentally terrible, but I mean just as a conjuncture. So I think that whole issue of the state and the left and feminism in the state is a very big area for discussion.
5 minutes and I saw three other hands. So this woman here, do you still have a question?
Yes.
And then this gentleman here, and that's probably all we have time for.
Hester, I am so delighted that you talked about the left, because there has been no union movement that the so much of the civil rights movement, of the uprisings, certainly the union movement, the women's movement, takes place because the left has a strategy and because it's involved in it. And what you said, aside from that being, you know, but I was delighted because people seem to think that strategies for progress and the working class take place outside the context of the people, the left, who think in terms of the working class as powerful. And I'm not sure you're familiar with, there's a lot of work that Nancy Gagan did on the UAW, especially on the whole question of whether there would be protective legislation. And if you look at the locals, as you discussed, Local 3 with Lee Fox leading it, Local 600, which was, because I think we used SWP, and I think that Local 600, that was largely a CP-led union, and that whereas you had the very conservative Ruther caucus still talking about family wage, still talking in the 50s about how his mother didn't have to work, and that huge demands of conventions that married women be prohibited from working as long as there were people laid off. And this is in the 40s and the 50s. And that I think that where the left failed in part was that the question of the same and different approach, protective legislation, isn't in large part what kept women on centrist arguments. And that meant separate departments, and that meant a whole seniority problem. And so there were no easy answers then. But to the extent we would like to see these movements revitalized, reignited, I don't think we can talk about the working class without talking about what's happened to the left.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My comment is about American beauty. It's American beauty, in my understanding, that throughout, and basically I like the point you made about the 1920s and all that, and how class was important, and how class was so important in the left movement, how it affected the feminist movement. And here comes the American beauty. The question of class, as you know, I follow American presidential elections, and as soon as there is any mention of race or anything, oh, you want to start a class war in America? We are trans-class society, so living in America, where almost everything, what you breathe, what you eat, where you marry, how you produce babies, how you make, everything is being stamped by class. And it is not that class is absent there, but what is absent is the working class, the laboring class, that this is a class project which takes the class out of the discourse. And the state is not absent. It is the state and class together have created an environment in which it has become difficult for the left we talked about class. And it affects the feminist movement, it affects the question that you talk of race, you talk of labor, you talk of women's question, from everywhere, that substance of class, because class was also supposed to be something bringing up what the people from below do, how they take their agency and where they confront the state. So here the state and the dominant class have created a situation where they are taking that agency out of them and making the discourse in a way that even talking about class has become difficult and almost impossible. And that is what I call the American beauty.
Any other comments from the panelists?
Just one to go back to the to whom do you turn? It seems to me that while we definitely need to have a large understanding of how as activists and advocates of social change we can engage with the state, while we have to have that enlarged discourse, seems to me that we also have to think differently about how the left and perhaps this race goes to the point that you're talking about. It seems to me that there's a lot of talk now about where is the left and why is the left seen so incapable at what for a number of reasons seems to be such an opportune moment. We have fault lines and cracks all over the place. The foundation is crumbling in a number of places, and we actually see things crumbling. Why is it that the left is not more visible, not more active? It seems to me that one of the things we have to do is rethink how the left historically has related with working class members of the working class. The working class is not just white, not just male, and the concept of identity, notwithstanding Todd Gitlin and a number of my friends, it seems to me that we have to begin to think differently about identity and how it reflects social location and agency, and figure out how to take seriously the lives of people, however they live them, and try to figure out how we can, as members of the left, relate to them so that the movement we build reflects not only the way in which we have to see ourselves, but the way folks, all these folks see themselves. And how can we have an understanding of oppression that is not exclusionary? How do we really understand the way in which oppression give rise to each other and nurture one another? And I think that makes a difference for how we try to intervene in ending those oppressions and trying to bring about social transformation.
Thank you. Thank you so much, everybody.